This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you are Gregory Carr, is that right?
Yes, sir.
How old are you, Gregory?
I am 13 years old.
And you're an African-American teenager in the St. Louis area. Where do you go to school?
I go to River Oaks Lutheran School. I'm in eighth grade.
Have you been following the events in Ferguson this week, Gregory?
Yes, sir, I have.
Can I ask you maybe a little sensitive question?
Yes, sir, you can.
Gregory, how many times have you thought about being shot and killed?
In my lifetime, about five.
Five times?
Yes.
Do you think something could happen to you in an encounter with the police?
Yes, it's very likely.
Thank you, Gregory. Hold on there for just a moment. And to all of you out there, very likely to have an unfortunate encounter with police. And having thought five times about being shot. Those are the data points from a 13-year-old African-American boy that begin this hour-long special on The Takeaway, Beyond Ferguson. How far is the road to never again? And is there a way to get everyone in America on that road? The truth is, statistically speaking, we don't exactly know if Gregory Carr Jr. should be afraid of being shot. Based on FBI reports, there are 96 cases of white officers killing a black citizen each year over the past 6 years, and that's based on the reporting of just a few hundred of the 17,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States. Well, think about this. A few weeks back, two white people were in a hospital in Atlanta being treated for Ebola. The entire nation was alarmed. What if it was 96 people? In our coverage of the events of Ferguson this hour, one question haunts us. Is there an urgency gap about these police shootings between the races? If so, why? Does it block our way to make change and achieving social justice in this country? We are grateful to the resources of St. Louis Public Radio for assisting us with this special coverage. Reporter Jason Rosenbaum has been covering this story since the protests began. Jason, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jason, over the past week, have you seen this community around St. Louis coming together and trying to bridge this urgency gap, or are you only seeing divisions?
I'm seeing a lot of divisions. The people that I've been talking to who are at protests or at press conferences, which are open to the public, many of them are from Ferguson, but many of them are from the surrounding area and across the country. And what they're telling me is there is this distrust between them and the judicial system, between them and law enforcement, and between them and other classes that are different from them. I think we're kind of in the early stages of this protest. I think it could be going on for a while until there's some finality with the officer being indicted or not being indicted. But it's clear at this point in time that people are frustrated, and it's going to take a while before I think a deep conversation can be had about what can be done to bridge the divide.
That's reporter Jason Rosenbaum of St. Louis Public Radio. Also there in the studios of St. Louis Public Radio, 13-year-old Greg Carr Jr. joins us once again, this time along with his father, Greg Sr. Thanks for being a part of this.
Thank you for inviting us.
Good to be here.
So, Greg Sr., what went through your mind as I was asking those questions of your son just a few moments ago?
A great deal of sadness, but at the same time, a reality. It is what we now know as the talk that African-American parents must have at some point in time with their African-American sons, that there is a possibility that they may be racially profiled, unjustly pulled over, or maybe even killed. So it's that uncomfortable conversation we have to have with our sons to prepare them for the reality.
And this is a conversation, this the talk conversation, is something you've had with other parents?
Yes. It's something that we all have discussed, particularly those of us with African-American male sons. And I was at a parent-teacher's meeting last night at my son's school. And after the meeting was over, it was a very short meeting, but we actually met outside of the school and had some serious discussions for about 30 minutes about the Ferguson situation and the need to have the community informed and to have our young people informed about their rights and how they should act in these certain situations and how to keep calm in these situations.
So this week you've been talking to other African-American parents saying, have you had the talk yet? Have you had the talk yet? Have you had the talk yet? That's been going
yes.
on? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Have you had the talk with Gregory Jr.?
We have. My wife and I have been having these conversations over the years, but we've been doing it incrementally because we wanted to make sure that he understood at his particular age. And Gregory just turned 13, so we felt that we needed to really give him a lot more information. And it's very ironic that the night before Michael Brown was shot, I was watching the documentary Eyes on the Prize, and I was watching the Emmett Till story. And I was struck, and I told Gregory, I said, Gregory, come and look at Emmett Till. I want you to see this. And I showed him a picture of Emmett Till before his demise, the picture his mother put in the coffin, and then they flashed a picture of him, his beaten face and this kind of reconstructed body. And I told him, I said, Emmett Till was only 1 year older than you, son. I said, we need to have these conversations. He said, Dad, why? He said, this really upsets me. And he began to talk to his mother about it. And I said, we need to start having these sorts of courageous conversations.
So what do you think of this courageous conversation business, Gregory?
Well, I think that these conversations are really going to help me through life, teach me to not be scared, how to fight through it and be brave.
Do you think we should get beyond Ferguson, that your generation should someday be able to say to your dad, you know, I think maybe I'm not going to have the same conversation with my son, Dad?
No, you always have to have this type of conversation with your next generation or the generation after that.
Always? That's so sad, though, Gregory.
It is, but it is the truth.
All right. So, Dad, do you think we can never escape this history? I mean, your dad had the same conversation with you, but it had to be a little different. The wording had to be different for your dad talking to you.
It was different, John. And the reason why I say it was different is my dad was a product of the South. He was from a little town called Henderson, Kentucky, right across the Ohio River from Evansville, Indiana. And if my dad were alive today, he would be, in fact, ironically, my dad would have turned 101 on the day that Michael Brown was killed, ironically. And he was a teenager during the 1920s, if that's possible. And during his time, if he was walking on a sidewalk, if a white man walked on the sidewalk, he immediately had to get off the sidewalk, lower his eyes, and not make eye contact. And if he were stopped by the police, he had to say yes, sir, and no, sir, to every question and never raise his voice. And that's the way he raised myself and my four brothers, to exactly use that. And I, for a long time, thought it was a very cowardly way to interact until I was stopped on a two-lane highway in East Central Illinois when I was in graduate school at the University of Illinois. And I literally believe my father's advice saved my life because the officer harassed me, profiled me, and asked me to hold a flashlight, a lit flashlight, to the side of my face for 35 minutes. And he kept asking me, he said, why are you so polite? I said, because that's what my father taught me. Whenever I'm stopped by the police, I say, yes, sir, no, sir. So I said, sir, I'm giving you respect because you are the police, sir. So therefore, I will respect everything you say, sir. And it helped keep me calm. And I realized that was my father's wisdom coming from the past that literally, I believe, saved my life because he was very hostile to me that night.
But what about the Constitution, which says you can question authority? What about the Constitution, which says it's okay to ask the authorities, whatever badge they're wearing, what's the problem?
John,
sir, why are you doing this?
I think that's a great question. The Constitution of the United States does give us that power, but historically the Constitution had to be amended for African Americans. If you go back in the annals of time, that we had to have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. So we're still dealing with only 150 years since the Emancipation Proclamation. So there's still a great deal of disenfranchisement that goes along with it. There are still individuals who still don't recognize African Americans as citizens of this country. So we have to educate ourselves.
Mr. Carr, before we go, do you think we can get beyond Ferguson in this country?
John, I think we can get beyond it, but I think it's going to take what I think I've coined this phrase now, a courageous conversation, not only with the citizens of Ferguson, but with the United States as a whole. we need to have a very serious dialogue about race. We cannot ignore it, but those things are uncomfortable.
Gregory Carr Sr. is an instructor at Harris Stowe State University in St. Louis, and his son Gregory Carr Jr. is 13 years old. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thank you.
Let's be clear here. An event in Ferguson has reopened a reality in America about race, justice, and fear. And this hour, we're not indicting cops or generalizing victims or excusing criminal behavior. We are exploring in conversation how whites and blacks may be responding differently to the events in Ferguson, even as we don't know the full facts there. Well, what do you say about this?
I'm a middle-aged white man in Seattle, and I think that black people should be given their rights, and they should not be shot down without recourse. Where is the justice? There's no justice. If people are being shot and nothing is done about it, then that's no justice. And without justice, how can we have a true, fair democracy?
Anna Castillo, San Antonio, Texas. I think a lot of us still see it as black and white because of the racial composition of the area. They have a history of police brutality in the area against black men. But it's an American problem because I think minorities, no matter what part of the country you're in, don't have any faith or trust in the police departments because they have minimal minority representation on the force.
Here's a thought from Chesterfield, Missouri. I have taught my children to be colorblind and treat everyone the same. My kids are dumbfounded by the comments they hear at school. We now live in a very white, very racist community. I've had to explain why so many people think they have a right to treat people differently, and it's not easy. Here's a thought from New York City. We don't discuss race at our house and think it's wonderful that our kids, 3 and almost 7, don't classify people based on their skin color. But my older son asked me while listening to NPR News in the car what a black man is, which led us into our first conversation about race.
Hi, my name is Jacob, and I'm from St. Charles. I'd like to say Ferguson is still seen as a racial issue rather than a national issue because racism has history here and it's easy to point a finger at. What is equally troubling is the little discretion given to the hiring of law enforcement. Their job is as important as those who create the laws. It's necessary to have the right people performing this duty.
This is Paul from Crystal, Minnesota. The main thing is if we didn't steal and if we would respect officers and not attack them and listen to what they say to us, I think that would be the biggest thing right there. And maybe, you know, we just need to get back some moral standings of, you know, law and order, maybe some rules. And I think that things would be a lot better.
Have the events in Ferguson prompted an important conversation around your dinner table? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And this conversation continues later today on Twitter. I'll be taking your questions and listening to your comments at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific. Follow at The Takeaway, and you can use the hashtag #BeyondFerguson, all one word, to join me and others as we discuss race, justice, and America, all on Twitter today at 6 p.m. Eastern. How tied are we to our racial history in America? Are police shootings like the one we experienced in Ferguson an unfortunate accident? Or the playing out of a grim script of racial division? We turn to someone who has thought about this quite a lot. Harvard professor Annette Gordon-Reed is the author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, an award-winning book about the hidden history of Thomas Jefferson's slave family. Annette Gordon-Reed, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So you write that Thomas Jefferson believed that the black people would never forget the wrongs done to them in slavery and that the white majority would never overcome its deep-rooted prejudices. I'm wondering if what we're seeing now in America is that dangerous, terrifying space between a cop and a young black man, unarmed in this particular case in Ferguson, is kind of the dividing line that Jefferson was talking about so long ago.
I think so. Because it goes to the question of citizenship, the question of how individuals who walk in the United States are treated by official power and the respect that official power accords or does not accord to individuals. And I think what happened there and what happens in many, many communities across the United States is that there is a lack of respect or a sense that black people are presumptively guilty. And that leads to a number of horrible situations, from deaths to just everyday harassment, which is a problem. It's demoralizing.
I'm going to give you three scenarios here, and they're certainly not exhaustive. But when a situation like the Michael Brown shooting happens, there's one scenario that says the cop was a racist. The other scenario is an unfortunate mistake. Somebody's really nervous and they pull the trigger by accident. But then there's another scenario which says that because of the historical baggage that you write about, that on some level, a white cop believes that society gives him permission to pull that trigger, and that that maybe explains why African-American young people die.
Well, there's a permutation on that last scenario, is that there's greater fear, I believe, of black people. A number of people have pointed out situations where whites have gotten into altercations with cops, have hit cops, have shot cops, have done all kinds of things, and they don't get killed. So it's almost as if there's a sense of a black person, black power, you know, that is menacing. But there's also the realization that killing black people is allowable in ways that it's not allowable to kill whites. So black lives are worth less than white lives. And that goes to the point that you're making. This is a historical thing. This is, comes from slavery. It comes from Jim Crow, the aftermath of slavery and Reconstruction, the idea that black lives are worth less. And if they're worth less, period, they are certainly not to be accorded the rights, the full panoply of rights of citizenship. The question is, how do we live together as equal citizens? And we haven't resolved that.
In your own community growing up, did you think about young people dying by gunfire? Did you talk with young males who were afraid or believed that this scenario would be the way they met their end?
Well, yes, because it happened. A person who was in my older brother's cohort was killed in police custody, multiple shots, supposed to have pulled a razor blade, not a razor, a razor blade out of an afro, which he didn't have, and attacked an officer. And in this instance, the officer was put on trial, but he was acquitted, self-defense, and it was pretty clear that nothing was going to happen to him. And there's always this fear of calling the police. A lot of times people in my community who were victims would not want to call the police because what could happen would be far worse than the thing that they would be complaining about. So, yeah, this was always a fear. And, you know, I grew up in a small community where we had one black police officer, and he was not allowed to arrest white people. He could only arrest black people. So there was this notion that whites were above blacks, and that played itself out in law enforcement every day.
Do you carry that ambivalence about law enforcement to the point where you might feel it having to dial 911 in Cambridge as a Harvard professor?
The Harvard professors have notoriously a problematic relation with the Cambridge police. I'm thinking about Skip Gates.
Right.
But I've called the police. But it depends. I will say that if I were dealing with a situation with a young black male and it was not something that was, you know, too serious, I mean, I would think twice about doing it because I don't know how he would be treated. And I would not want his death or, you know, disfigurement or whatever on my hands. And the fact that that runs through my mind is problematic.
When we see the people in the streets and the, you know, violence and the unrest and the police in riot gear and all the sort of aftermath of something like the Michael Brown shooting, I'm just drawn to ask myself, what happened at the moment? It seems to me there's some sort of signature set of circumstances that makes this happen. And I don't know what it is, but it seems like there's a pattern, and it turns out in this dreadfully awful way.
It's a number. It's a perfect storm. You have young males who are young and by definition impulsive, who have a keen sense of fairness and not wanting to be mistreated. And the lack of communication and a lack of, I think, empathy on the part of officers who don't see these young people as young people, don't see black people as people in the same way, and it gets out of hand. And this happens over and over again. And old habits die hard. So I think we have to integrate police forces and better training. And these are policy choices. There are some things that can be done.
So you have hope that there is a fix, that we don't have to live out this kind of prescription from Thomas Jefferson, that we'll never cross this divide.
Oh, I have hope that it will change. I'm not hopeful that it's going to be quick. It's not something that I think is going to be in my lifetime. But we have to start working on it. I mean, obviously, we've come a long way. A lot has happened that Jefferson could never have envisioned. But it's not easy. It's not going to be easy. I think a number of people thought, we have a black president, so everything's okay. That was never going to be true.
Annette Gordon-Reed is the author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, professor at Harvard University. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now let's think about this. Do the radically different impressions of the criminal justice system in America have a basis in fact and practice? Are young African-American men wrong to feel as though the system is stacked against them? Are their parents wrong to feel that the authorities might go after their children, while white parents seem to have very little to fear? Robin Steinberg is the executive director of the Bronx Defenders, a public defender's office and advocacy organization. She joins us in our studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So is the system out to get African-Americans? Is that realistic fear?
The system certainly targets African-American and men of color. There's no question about that.
Did you always believe that?
Always. If you walk into a criminal courthouse in any place in America, particularly here in New York City, and you see who's being hauled into the criminal justice system for conduct that's not being policed in other communities, you only walk away with one conclusion, which is that the criminal justice system, for whatever the reasons are, is being used as a lever against poor communities and particularly communities of color.
Before you were a lawyer, did you believe that when you were growing up as an American citizen? Did you have that idea?
I don't think that I understood that before I became a lawyer, but certainly when I stepped foot in criminal court, I knew it right away.
Give me an example of how individuals find themselves in court under arrest for reasons that just you find illegitimate, and then whites would never have that same experience.
So for the past about 25 years, there's been a shift in the paradigm of policing in this country. It's moved from sending police officers into communities to seek individuals who are actually committing crimes to sending police officers into particular communities, looking at the community itself as the target, and then treating minor infractions as if they were serious offenses. That's broken windows quality of life policing. That's led to shoveling millions of people into the criminal justice system from the communities that are targeted, right, that would not actually happen in other more affluent and white communities. So you see people coming into the system for low-level possession of marijuana, trespass, graffiti, riding your bicycle on the street, holding an open container of beer on a summer night. You see communities of color, and particularly African-American men, being targeted by the police for those low-level offenses. And that's bringing them into contact with the criminal justice system.
And so the consequences of that are, if you're standing on the street, you have reason to fear if a cop car turns around the corner.
If you are an African-American man or a man of color in this country and a police car goes by, I think it is reasonable to be concerned about whether or not you're about to be stopped, questioned, frisked, harassed, intimidated, the kinds of interventions that go on every single day in low-income communities and communities of color.
Now, you know, one of the benefits of that is, hey, you know, we've got a lower crime rate in the city and around the nation. So, hey, it's a price we have to pay.
Well, I know that's what the police would like people to believe. I have to say that there's absolutely no evidence to support the idea that broken windows quality of life policing is the thing that led to the reduction in crime. The reduction in crime has been seen across this country in jurisdictions that use this form of policing and jurisdictions that don't. If you look at some of the most recent violent confrontations where police officers have shot unarmed black men in the streets of our cities, you will see that almost each and every one of those interactions started as one of these broken windows policing interactions. Somebody's walking down the street and they want to know why they're walking down the street. There is a perceived suspicion by the police about communities of color that doesn't exist for other communities.
And if someone sees a cop coming who's an African-American in one of these communities that you're describing and isn't in a great mood and gets stopped, what can that lead to? In other words, how does a situation go from holding a bottle of beer to some sort of violent encounter where suddenly, you know, firearms come out?
You know, when you collectivize enforcement of policing, and you target communities over and over again with the constant use of stops and questions and intimidation and heightened surveillance of those communities. Eventually, those communities begin to ask questions. And I think what you wind up seeing is the mere questioning of why somebody's being stopped, the questioning of that authority will lead to an escalation oftentimes by the police officers in that interaction, and often leads to violence.
Now, people listening might say, you know, Mr. Hockenberry, you're only talking to, you know, one counselor here in the courtroom here. If you were talking to a prosecutor, it would be a different story. Here's the view of an experienced police officer from the LAPD, 17-year policeman. And he argues in the Washington Post, you know, behave yourself and nothing will happen. Quote, even though it might sound harsh and impolitic, here's the bottom line. If you don't want to get shot, tased, pepper sprayed, struck with a baton, or thrown to the ground, just do what I tell you. Don't argue with me. Don't call me names. Don't tell me I can't stop you. Don't say I'm a racist pig. Don't threaten that you'll sue me and take away my badge. Don't scream at me that you pay my salary. And don't even think of aggressively walking towards me. Most field stops are complete in minutes. How difficult is it to cooperate for that long? What's unreasonable about that?
That is not the country we live in. Absolute power is going to corrupt absolutely. And the problem that we see here is that nothing happens to the police officers when they overstep their bounds. The idea that a police officer would actually say, you can't question why I'm being stopped, or ask a police officer, I'm sorry, officer, what's the problem? Why are you stopping me? Why are you searching me? Fundamental to our very belief about ourselves as Americans in this country. The idea that you can't challenge that in a lawful, peaceful way is appalling. You know, the hallmark of absolute power, right, is that there's no accountability. And that's what we see in the police departments now across this country.
What gets us beyond Ferguson in America, do you think?
You have to stop arresting people for low-level infractions and end broken windows policing, which I do think leads to the sort of collectivization of enforcement and leads to more and more violence. You have to create accountability in and outside the police departments. You have to demilitarize the police department. Images of tanks and SWAT teams and riot-geared police officers outnumbering the protesters on the streets of Ferguson really, really does speak of a disproportionality of the response to protest in this country, and a kind of dangerous lawlessness that the police seem to have.
Robin Steinberg, your personal reflections on the events of this week?
This isn't a problem for the black community only. This is a problem. This is an American problem. And it's one that should galvanize each and every one of us. There should be conversations going on around kitchen tables all across this country, not just in African-American homes. We should be speaking about this. We should be speaking out about this. We should be demanding a change in the way that African-Americans and men of color are being policed and treated in the criminal justice system in this country. And it's all of our problems, and it's all of our responsibilities.
Robin Steinberg is executive director of the Bronx Defenders, a public defender's office and advocacy organization here in New York City. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's return now to that idea of the father-son talk that the Cars shared with us at the top of the hour, an African-American dad cluing his son in on what he considers to be the racial realities of American life, including the dangers that might lurk in encounters with police. Well, how does that talk change if the son is black but the father is a cop and white, and in this case, gay? Captain Kevin Fisher Paulson is with the San Francisco Sheriff's Department. He and his adopted son, 11-year-old Zane, know all about the talk.
There was an issue last year with a 13-year-old boy named Andy Lopez who was shot by a police officer in Santa Rosa, and he was carrying a toy gun at the time, and my son Zane sat at the kitchen table as we were listening on the radio about it, and he started crying. And I said, Zane, why are you crying? And he said, could that happen to me? And it began the discussion with him about police officers and race. And the situation in Ferguson brought up the issue again about police officers and race, because we like to think we live in a post-racial society. I am the white father of a black child and a mixed race child, and I'd like to think that those issues don't matter anymore. But I had to be honest with him in that sometimes in the world, there are still people who will profile an 11-year-old boy simply based on his race. That's the hardest part, that an innocent 11-year-old boy could be looked on as a threat.
Did your adoption of Zane in some sense pull you out of a bubble in that you never really had thought about this much until it became clear just how in danger Zane might be at some point?
It was a moment of strange cultural awareness. I grew up in the pretty insular white Irish Catholic family, and I didn't understand the magnitude of the problems that a black man could face in this society until my children moved into the home. We took my sons to Maine, which is where my husband is from, and the family was all trying to be nice to us, but one of his relatives said, "Oh my gosh, look how big his lips stick out." And I thought, wow, she's trying to be nice, but she doesn't realize how offensive a remark like that could be. And we've been to baseball games, movie theaters, visiting people in other states where my 11-year-old son was looked on as being suspect if he walked around by himself in a store. So, yes, raising a black child has certainly awoken my awareness of race in America.
Thinking about the incident in Ferguson and using your perspective as a cop, what do you think broke down?
I think none of us know all the facts to the case right now, and I want to emphasize that I don't know all the facts. But I will say that the problem started a long time before that incident. What happened there was tragic. But looking at the fact that it was mainly an African-American community and there were mainly white police officers was the first step of there not being room for communication. That communication's got to come from a cultural competence, and the cultural competence comes from diversity. So the very first thing was there should have been recruitment for more minorities in their police officer agency. Having said that, there was no true and meaningful dialogue with the community about it. They were circling the wagons and they were protecting themselves. And then rather than begin a community dialogue, they began driving around in Humvees. And had there been a meaningful dialogue in the beginning, we wouldn't have gotten to the point where there were that many protests. A community does not protest if they feel like they're being heard. The path out of this is both the police and the community learning how to speak with each other. And that involves townhouse meetings, community meetings, and raising awareness of the needs of different groups.
You know, what if, no matter what you do, no matter how many talks you have with your son, Zane, he sees all these slights and people looking at him and notes these points at which he can be in harm's way because he's black, and accumulates an anger and becomes a young man and has a anger towards the cops that you can't do anything about. How fearful will you be if that's his future?
I can't say I live without fear, and I can say the only answer is the kitchen table. We sit at the kitchen table every night, and every night we have dinner together. And I've seen anger in Zane. When Zane is feeling most frightened and most vulnerable, I'll give you a quick example. One day when I didn't buy him a sweatshirt that he wanted when we were at the baseball stadium, he started running. And when I finally caught up with him, he yelled loudly, as loud as he could, "Don't let this man stop me. He's not my real father. My real father is black." And of course, within 10 seconds, there were three police officers surrounding me. And I realized at the time that when Zane is most fearful, Zane feels that he is the most different, and being a straight black son of a white gay man, being a non-peace officer son of a peace officer, he will always go to his place of fear when he feels he's different. So I say we go back to the kitchen table and remind each other every night that we sit at the same kitchen table, we talk about the same issues every day, and we may be different. He may be tall, I may be short, he may be thin, I may be thick, but we are ultimately the same family. I have to live in that hope, and that my son can be a leader of that hope in the future.
Kevin, I just have to think that down deep inside of you, you must really fear that that anger is going to go off someday, sometime, and you're not going to be there to protect him.
I do worry about that. It's the tough role for any parent, not just an adoptive parent. But the tough thing is, how can I keep my child protected when I'm not there to protect him? Especially when my child is more at risk than the average child. And I don't have an easy answer for that. I wish I did. And that's one of the things that keeps me up at 2 in the morning. How can I keep him safe? And now that he's 11 years old and pretty tall for his age, pretty strong, I worry. But I can't live in fear. And so he and I go on doing the best we can. And the only way that you can spite hopelessness is to reach out for hope. So that's what we do.
Kevin Fisher-Paulson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Kevin Fisher-Paulson is a captain with the San Francisco Sheriff's Department. He and his husband have two adopted sons, Zane, black, and his younger brother, mixed race. They are a family having some very serious conversations around their kitchen table this week. Hope that's what we're going for this hour. We want to thank all of you for joining us. Tell us about the conversations you're having in your kitchen after the events of Ferguson, Missouri.
Hi, this is Will Kessler from St. Paul, Minnesota. I like to talk to my family about not so much what happened in Ferguson, but more about what comes from it, like the term minority. When you phrase things as a minority or a majority, you're really just separating people. And it is an American issue. It's an issue of how we treat each other. And if we want to solve our problems, we need to move past labeling people and just call them people.
How best to convey to the world and to each other in our neighborhoods that we're all in this together. We want to thank everybody for listening, for being a part of this conversation, for making your voice a part of this hour. A special thanks to our good friends at St. Louis Public Radio. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. At 6 p.m. Eastern Time today, I'll be doing a Twitter chat on all of this, and you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.